vibrate at certain rates, which is becomes the basis of medicine based upon the frequency of vibration of particular organs. So they mapped out the frequencies of different parts of your body. And these are the normal ranges. Now, your body, your organ's not vibrating at those particular rates. That means there's something wrong with your basic, that particular organ is not doing well. And based on that, then they try to bring your vibration back to the normal rate. And then you get cured. So that's the basic idea of vibration. So they dealt with a little science based on that. So it deals with physical diseases, mental problems, etc. And they got some success in that. So this has been investigated. It's not part of normal Western medicine at the moment. But in the early 20th century, some people were experimenting with this one person, Dr. Reif, and he did a lot of work on frequency of the vibration of different organs of your body and how you can adjust them to come to good health. So he developed a whole science based on vibrations and a little machine to do it also to help you get back to normal vibration, improve your health, etc. If you want, you look on the internet to find lots of information on his research and science and whatever. You still have little machines and maybe little machines that help you out with your vibrational frequencies, etc. So this is one aspect. Another, of course, is brain waves naturally have some frequency to them. And in modern science, they have these four categories, the delta wave, the theta wave, alpha wave, and the beta wave, the wave waves, the waking state. So there's some frequency changes there from very, very low frequency to increased frequency, more frequency than the waking state, which is the most active, we can say, it's 14 hertz vibration. And you know, the alpha state is very important because this is a state of meditation and realization and things like that. It's kind of conscious but not conscious at the same time. So very important stage as well. Apart from that type of brain waves, you're having waves, you have thoughts and feelings which are expressed in the waves as well. So, in the modern world, they've also developed techniques of interpreting those brain waves to figure out what your thoughts are. In other words, they can read your brain. They can read your thoughts. Get your brain waves. So they developed machines to do that. And of course, they've done the opposite as well. They can put waves into your brain and make it think certain things. So they control your thought process as well, or your emotions. So this is, of course, a little dangerous because you get mind control. Make everybody think of certain things you want them to think of or have certain emotions concerning certain things. And this way people lose their free will. But that's one aspect that can be done with brain waves to control your thoughts. So another area. Then we have earth vibrations. We don't usually think about this, but actually science has discovered that the Earth vibrates at its natural pulse at 7.3 hertz. These vibrations are coming out of the Earth. It's called the Schumann resonance. And very interestingly, this is also the alpha wave in your brain. That possible alpha wave state is also going at the same rate. So in other words, there's some synchronicity or synchronization between the earth wave and your brain wave in a very restful, creative state. Okay, so that's another interesting thing. This is that frequency. Someone vibrates from the earth and goes up into the ionosphere, etc., and creates this new wave that goes around the earth. Thus, the earth is a little more complicated than we think it is. It has certain spots, especially, which are very inspirational because they vibrate at a certain rate and very nicely in their natural state, etc. So, in the New Age, they talk about, you know, sacred spots and things like this. In India, we have tirthas and things like this, very special places that are very good for spiritual development, etc. So, in other words, the earth has got some spiritually conducive spots on it, which are better than other spots for getting this particular vibration, etc. So we should not think of the earth as this dull piece of matter. Its vibrations often will harmonize with the human brain vibration when it's in a very restful state, and it becomes very powerful to give us inspiration and spiritual development. So therefore the idea of holy tirthas is not, you know, ridiculous after all. It's got some scientific basis. Then we have musical vibrations. Every society in the world, the mobile or primitive societies, they have some sort of music and song, etc. And then we have very advanced music, or more advanced music, but we have ragas in India, and we have Western classical music. They developed the scales, etc. And more or less they develop the same scales we have in India in terms of relationship of different frequencies. So notes are based on frequencies also. And we go from A to B to C, etc., or Sa, Re, Ga, etc. It's all based on frequency, and there's a mathematical relationship between the frequencies of the different notes. Very surprising, but very, very mathematical is the relationship between notes of music. And if you have very accurate vibrations, then you get very nice music. this is also very, very different. Persons have investigated this around the world, frequency of notes, etc. And some people have even theorized how certain vibrations will also affect your body. So we have chakras in your body, from the Muladhara chakra, and the second chakra, third chakra, the navel, the fourth chakra, your heart, the fifth chakra, the voice box, and the one in the ear. So they all have certain frequencies also, so which are musical modes as well. So therefore, music is very intimately associated with the human body as well. And of course, different chakras are responsible for different physical functions and then spiritual functions as well. The top end, as we go upward, becomes more spiritual. So they can be used for healing. Sound can be used for healing. Notes can be used for healing. And also for spiritual development, because the higher chakras are the spiritual chakras, and higher rating in certain ranks. So a lot of research has been done on the effect of music. So scientists began to experiment with music and how it affected plants. Now, plants do not have a very developed nervous system, so they can't hear because they don't have ears like we have. But nevertheless, they were very surprised to find that different types of music affect plants in different ways. So when you have classical music or Vedic music based on ragas, that was very good for the plants, and they grew very nicely. And if you had some very noisy rock music or heavy rock music, etc., the plants tend to die. So plants are affected by different types of music. Surprisingly, we don't know why plants would do that, but because they don't even have ears. And these are scientific studies, not done by devotees or any pure Western scientists. Even in 1973, they investigated sound and how plants were affected by the sound. Then we have animals affected by sound. And again, we use a nice classical Verdi's music or Mozart music, etc. This would be pretty good for the immune system of the rats, or I guess the mice. They wanted to measure how they would recover, so they used different types of music to give them a heart operation, and they'd see if they recovered quickly or less quickly. So that the classical music, if they had that music, they recovered quickly, which means that it was good for them. And the ones that had the bad music or one continuous tone, etc., they failed. They didn't recover from the operations, etc. And not only in terms of recovery, intelligence was affected by music in the animals as well. And Right, so they would test them by having the rats go, or mice go through a little puzzle, even a little maze, like to see how they can get through it. And then they play them that music, so they'll play Strauss music or Mozart music like that. And they went through quicker. In other words, their intelligence increased. Something happened in their brain. The brain cells were very active. And then they had like rhythmic music or just heavy, loud music like that. And they failed. Couldn't get through the maze. And in fact, they became cannibalistic and they began eating each other up. So music had that effect on small animals. So, very profound effect of music. There is I don't know if it's true or not, but there was one story of a high school student who did something on the rats also, or the mice, and so he had them do the classical music thing, and the rats very nice. And then he also did the thing with the heavy rock music. And those rats, they start killing each other. Just with rock music. I mean, they put the rock music on all day long for the rats, and they're going crazy, basically. Beware. Your children are got these earphones on them all day long, they may have bad effects on them. Okay, and they discovered classical music that, chemically speaking, the classical music reduced cortisol. Cortisol is the bad chemical in the body. This is the one that increases stress, and then stress causes all sorts of problems. So, this music, relaxing music, help reduce the stress and the cortisol. Okay. And opposite, we have this loud music or brass music, marching music, etc. It increases your cortisol. So that's why they use it in armies. They have brass bands in the army. So that increases your cortisol and your aggressive instincts, etc. It's very good in one sense for fighting. But in prolonged stage, it ultimately ruins the body. Okay. So, therefore, they said this prolonged exposure to fast, heavy, or heavy metal music may induce addictive cortisol levels like coffee.
Is that a similar effect with our loud drumming or loud beat?
Could be also. If it's too loud, you get the same effect. It's very nice in one sense, makes you enthusiastic. On the other hand, it got very bad physical effects on your body. Bang, 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 bang. So be careful of that. And sound is a weapon. So as I said, you know, they could use the brain waves to influence your mind and that. So they actually developed weapons to cause you to have certain emotions, to panic, or to paralyze you, make you sick and vomit, and do all sorts of things like that. These are sound weapons, which are developed by the different military governments of the world. So sound, therefore, is a very wide spectrum of uses, from very positive, healing, to very negative, to, you know, paralyzing you, making you go crazy. That's material sound. Very, very profound effect on the human body. As I said, all molecules are vibrating at a certain rate, so we'll just speak of, you know, higher living energies. We've got all sorts of vibrations in the body, and sound can influence in all sorts of ways, either positively or negatively. You can also think of it in terms of gunas. So in Bhagavad Gita, we have a description of sattva being very peaceful and in charge of maintenance of the body, repair, etc. Rajas is very stimulating and creative, passionate, and tamasic is very destructive. So everything in the world is classified in terms of gunas, like this. So we got all sorts of things in terms of food and health and worship and knowledge and values and action and music. So that some music is sattvic. That's the peaceful music that helps to restore the balance of the body. We have very rajasic music, which will excite you a lot, but ultimately not good for you. Then we have the tamasic music, which is, makes you go crazy and destroys your body. Another interesting thing is that sound has form. So you think, okay, sound is a wave that goes in your ear. But also, it has a certain form. So they developed a science called cymatics. And they got a little instrument here, you see, with a microphone. You can't see it so clearly. There's a keyboard attached to, which gives sound, and this is attached with a little machine here, and there's a little plate on top with some like little sand particles or something on it. And then when you put a note, that will vibrate the plate at a certain frequency, and that produces patterns. So therefore we see that the notes of the scale, like A or B or C or D, have distinct patterns actually made out of the sand with different patterns for the different notes of the scale. So each note has a particular form, we can say, associated with it.
Very interesting.
And the dissonant notes may have very peculiar patterns like this. And you see in India, we have mantras. Mantras are sound. But then we have yantras, which are two-dimensional, geometric representations of the mantra. So again, we have a shape or a form representation of a mantra in terms of the yantra, which also represents the universe at the same time. So the mantra is usually written somewhere within the yantra, and the syllables are all there, etc. And it's expressed in this in terms of circles and squares radiating outwards, which are very symmetrical with many, many mantras. And this corresponds to the actually the whole universe. It's also based on very symmetrical mathematical principles. So we have the whole galaxy operating on a spiral, and that spiral follows mathematical rules of expansion. And similarly, the spiral in the seashell, the spiral in the pine cone or the sunflower seed, etc., like that. So the same pattern is repeated throughout nature again, very much like the yantras, which we know are very, very symmetrical as well. And we have ragas. Ragas are selection of moods to evoke a certain mood and a certain image. But in classical music in India, the raga actually represents a personality, a person. So along with the raga, they'll have a little verse that describes the person. So the person may be a man or a woman. They may have a certain complexion, dark complexion, blackish complexion, golden complexion, white complexion, whatever. They have certain ornaments, they're holding certain things in their hands, they're sitting or standing or dancing or whatever like this, surrounded by others or alone or whatever. So each raga has a particular form, which is described in Sanskrit. So the raga, the selection of notes, has a form as well. That's a personality. This actually is a Hindola raga. And this one, a Hindola is the swing. So it's Krishna, Radha and Krishna on a swing, actually. That's the description of Hindola raga. So the artists in ancient India, they became very attracted to these ragas and how they were represented. They began to do pictures of all the different ragas and their meanings, etc. And this one here is the Vishnu Shesha. So raga is the it's an extended form of notes, whatever, and it has a form as well. So the other aspect of sound, which is interesting, is sound forms words, and words gives us information, knowledge. So this is a very important aspect of sound, which is developed in the human being, not much developed in the animals. They may have limited sounds. Human being has greater variety of sounds and words, etc. And the words are expressed in relationships, so therefore we have grammar, and we have sentences, and the sentences are related to other sentences, so we have whole, you know, thought development based on the words. So this is very important for the human being, and we get all sorts of knowledge that way as well. So this sound, according to modern science, is air vibrations going into your ear, etc., whatever. And this way we get knowledge coming into our brain through words, sound representing words, whereas we think about that sound as a word, and then it goes in our brain and we think and we get a concept or whatever, abstract concept. So we're very powerful. That's Western idea of sound. Vedic sound is a little bit different one. This ear is not the real ear. This eye is not the real eye, according to modern science. But then we say it's the ear. If you look in the Bhagavatam, you'll find when you die, your eye and your ear and your nose go with you out of the body. And they sit in a subtle body and they enter into your next body. So the eye and the ear and the nose are not these ones which are brought away. There's something that go with you, very subtle. Material, but part of your subtle body. So that's the real eye, ear, nose, etc. These are the real organs, sense organs. These are gross representations of that. So therefore, when you hear, we think we're hearing this ear, but they just say, no, you're hearing with that other subtle ear, which you can't even see. You're seeing with a different eye also. So that's why when you're dreaming, you can also hear and see, but these are not functioning at all, because your subtle eye is functioning in that way. And when you die, all of those go with you. Or when you have a subtle body experience, near-death experience, you see things, you hear things. But your brain dead, so these are not functioning at all. So it's your subtle eye, your subtle ear, which are functioning at that time. So you have two sets of material senses, subtle and gross. Not like modern science, but material senses. A little bit more complex than we think it is, the perceiving things, because we have the two sets of eyes sort of together. And then the third canto is a little description of the different organs and the different sense objects. Sound is one of the sense objects, and they have a particular element related to them. So sound is the aspect of ether. And sound here is not just any sound, it's that which conveys the idea of an object. So it is information, actually, that sound. Not like the word that has information for it. So that's what real sound is, according to Vedic literature. So, there's another aspect of sound, that is spiritual sound. So not only have a subtle sound with the subtle ear, but then we have a real subtle sound, that is spiritual sound, the Vedas, which come out of the breathing of Vishnu, high agreement. So that's not material sound at all, that's a spiritual sound. So we have so many descriptions of the Vedic sound, starting with the one little syllable, little om, and how that is the seed sound of the whole universe. It's a basic spiritual sound which expands into the Gayatri Mantra. And the Gayatri Mantra expands into four Vedas. So one sound expands itself into all the Vedic literature, which has so many sounds in it, but it's actually one little sound, the Om. And so a very powerful sound, which is that's glorified in the Upanishads. And that sound is not different from Vishnu in the Vedas. So there is probably a spiritual sound representing the Supreme Lord. There are many quotations from the Vedas glorifying the syllable Om, like this from the Chandogya Upanishad. And this sound is very important in the creation of the universe. In Bhagavatam we have a description of how Mahavishnu glances over property and produces the different elements which form into universes and injects the jiva into the matter as well, and they enter into the universe. And then when the Lord decides it's time to destroy everything, everything dissolves, everything goes back into Mahavishnu again. And it's breathing of Mahavishnu and sound. It's through sound that everything evolves and is dissolved. We see in the Brahma Samhita there's a description of Brahma. And at a certain point when he's trying to create the universe, he hears Krishna's flute, and that actually becomes the Gayatri Mantra, Vedic Gayatri Mantra, and it goes in his ear. And that's his initiation or his diksha. And with that mantra, then he has the power to create the universe. So in other words, that sound gives him power to create. And so then sound again is essential for the creation of the universe. This is this from Brahma. I bestow my powers on you. You now possess the necessary powers for creation, O Brahma. Now create the bodies for living entities in this universe. I did it through Gayatri Mantra. Even science, of course, it's all hypothetical. They also say the sound was also there at the beginning of the universe in terms of Big Bang, etc. Sound waves that rang out in the early universe sculpted its structure. The best measurement yet of the imprint on galaxies is a boom to dark energy studies. About 30,000 years after the Big Bang, matter collapsed around dense seeds of dark matter. Outward pressure from photons caused the collapsing matter to rebound, creating acoustical waves, sound waves, that is, like ripples in the pond. So, beginning of creation, I use sound waves going everywhere from the universe, aiding the creation. That's the universe, modern science. So, even modern science, like sound has something to do with the creation of the universe. Okay, so let's get a little more spiritual. So, back to the Vedas and the spiritual sound. So, spiritual sound is concentrated in mantra. Mantra is sound. But mantra actually has power to it. It's not regular sound. It's not regular material words. This particular sound can deliver the mind, control the mind, etc. What makes it different? Actually, it's not material at all. It is spiritual sound. Somehow, it's able to manifest in this material world. And we can hear it, even though it's spiritual sound. And we think it's material sound, but actually spiritual sound. So there is a whole process by which it becomes audible to us, according to the Vedic literature. It is spiritual in nature, but it evolves by a certain process so that we can hear it with our ears. So it goes through these four stages, para, vasanti, madhyama, and vaikari. And gradually, as it does this, when it comes to the vaikari stage, we can say it with the voice, and we can hear it with the ear. So that's what we normally think is sound. But actually, it's like para, it's spiritual in nature. And then it develops, gradually develops these coverings, a little bit so you can detect it mentally a little bit with your mind, and then you can think about it, and logically, you say, oh, that's the sound of this or that, whatever, and finally you can say it. So these are the four stages of development of spiritual sound to manifest within our normal material, to our material senses. And it goes through the chakras, the Muladhara chakra, the Manipura chakra, and the Visuddha chakra, and then it goes out from the throat to the voice, and you can say it, you say the mantra, and you hear the mantra. But it is essentially spiritual. So throughout this, we have that para aspect there. But it develops these different layers which you can perceive with our material senses, the mind and the intellect, and finally with the ear and the voice. And when we perceive it with our senses, like the voice and the ear, that's called vaikari sound. But it doesn't lose its spiritual nature. So that's why it's different from other material sound, which only has that top level without the bottom level to it. So it is different from material sound. It's quite different. So that sound comes in the spiritual world, manifests gradually our voice, we hear it through here, and then its effect is different because of that spiritual element. So it can get back in, it can influence the Atma, it can change the Atma, which is spiritual, and it takes to the spiritual world eventually. So this is how mantra delivers the jiva. By spiritualizing it. So, in modern science, they have investigated different things on how they can affect us. We saw with the rats or the mice or the glands, the sound was affecting them. So they tried the mantras. So we have some serious studies of chanting Gayatri Mantra and Sanskrit mantras and
what effect it has on the body. So they did that, and they found that, yes, if we look at the cells, if we look at the chromosomes and DNA, that it actually had an effect. Those mantras had an effect of unwinding the DNA. When they get all tangled up, and this is a problem, and it causes, you know, health things and aging, etc. And untangles, and it's healthy state. So they found that the chanting of the Vedic mantras started to unwind the DNA. Powerful effect. It was, of course, material again. Another research was done on the chromosomes, and they found that sickness and aging is caused by deterioration of the telomeres, which are these little things on the caps of your chromosomes. They got a little cap on them, like a little cover. And they start getting shorter and shorter and weaker, and then you start getting all sorts of diseases, and old age, and your body decays. Okay? So there's a direct correlation between the telomeres and your health. And so if we examine you, and we try different techniques and whatever, and then we look at your telomeres, if your telomeres start getting better, we say, okay, that had a positive effect on your health. It's not imaginary, it's physical in terms of the repair of the telomeres. So they tried various things, like soft music, relaxing music, 2 or 3% improvement. They tried exercise, like walking every day for 10 minutes. Okay, you get another 2% increase. Vegetarian food, also good, 2 or 3, 4 or 5% like that, improves your telomere strength. They tried other exercises like Tai Chi, you know, things like the slow movements and Chinese thing, a little too complicated for people. They tried yoga, that was also good, 2 or 3, 4% like that, 5%. They tried group discussion. And they sit in a group and they just discuss together. That's good, 5% also, increase like that. So from various things they got some increase and repair of the telomeres. And then they had music and they had singing as well. That also was very good. Then they tried kirtan. When they did kirtan, they get 43% increase of the telomeres. A very, very good effect. So this is because, of course, we got a combination of singing and good food and group together and exercise and music and mantra. So we got a very powerful combination there to actually physically affect the cells and the chromosomes of the body to increase the telomeres. Oh, very remarkable effect. This, of course, is all physical. The main use of the mantra is not physical at all, but we can see that it does have very powerful physical effects as well. And these are things that you can scientifically measure by looking at getting a microscope and then looking at the telomeres and see if they're getting stronger, etc. So, very interesting effect. So, of course, apart from the gross body, then we have the more subtle body, that is the mind, etc., and how it can relax you, etc. So they've done studies on that also. They found, yes, it has very good psychological effects on the body. That it lowers the heart rate, etc. But the main effect we're interested in is spiritual effect, which cannot be measured scientifically at all. So for that we have to go to the scriptures. And we just rely on the scriptures to give us proof of what the mantra can do for us spiritually. So, mantra is sound, which is very specific. It is spiritual sound. And it actually represents the object. So we have the name of God. It actually is not different from the form of God. It is spiritual. So we say the word Krishna. It is Krishna. So that is the power behind the mantra, particularly the name of the Lord. So if we repeat the name of the Lord, then we can realize Krishna. We can realize the spirit of the Lord, not just his form,
but his qualities, his activities, etc. So this is a spiritual effect that can give us a direct realization of God. So we have, of course, many different mantras. Some of the mantras, of course, are more complex, like the Vedic mantras, the Gayatri mantra, etc. They actually require good qualification to chant, and therefore it's not advised that normal people use those mantras. You have to have diksha, etc. You have to be a Brahmin or something like this, and chant it with certain svaras, etc. So a little more complex. But the name of the Lord is very liberal, very free. Doesn't require any qualification, doesn't require to be Brahmin, doesn't require initiation or anything. And the effect is even more powerful. So that is why Lord Chaitanya chose Nam Sankirtan as the main process. Very, very powerful name of the Lord. And we also sing it together. That's Nam Sankirtan. And we get very powerful effect. Of course, we have the physical effects, but then we have the spiritual effect as well. In the Brihad Bhagavatamrita, there's a whole story of how a young boy in Vrindavan got a mantra from his guru, a secret Krishna mantra, 12 syllable Krishna mantra, and he repeated that to himself, to chapel with this. And he got all sorts of realizations and whatever from that. But after he got to the spiritual world, Vaikuntha, etc., then Narada, when he said, actually, if you want to get the highest realization of Krishna and go to Goloka, then you have to do Nam Sankirtan. So then he started chanting the name of the Lord, and then he went to Goloka. So in other words, though we start out with the holy name of the Lord, actually it's the highest process, and at least it's the highest goal, more than the mantras do even. A very, very powerful process. So of course, we have the name Krishna, but Lord Chaitanya has also given us the name of Radha. So Hare is from Haraha, and we're calling out to Radha, Radhe, so becomes Hare. So we have not only Krishna, we have Radha, so we have a little more extra mercy there for Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. We got not only the name of Krishna, we also have the name of Radha, who's his Padini Shakti, energy of bliss. So, actually, both represent bliss. The name Krishna means, literally from the Gautamiya Tantra, Krishna means the source of everything. So he's the most powerful. He is the source of everything in the spiritual world and everything in the material world. So even the source of all division forms and avatar forms, that's Krishna. Nam means the source of all bliss. So any happiness in the material world, happiness in Brahman, happiness in Vaikuntha is all emanating from Krishna and Goloka. So he's the ultimate source of bliss as well. So all power and all sweetness and all bliss are in Krishna. So very, very powerful thing, because we realize Krishna, all power and all bliss. In Hare Krishna we chant the name Rama. So Rama literally means the one who gives bliss. One who gives enjoyment. And of course, Hare comes from Hara, and Hara is Radha, and Radha is Padini Shakti of the Lord, the bliss Shakti of the Lord. So another form of bliss. So we get the whole Hare, Krishna, and Rama is all bliss, highest bliss of all. So, we get a very top experience by chanting the Hare Krishna mantra. So, just to summarize, the mantra can affect your body. We saw with the telomeres, etc. It can affect your mind, become less stressed, peaceful, etc. And it affects the Atma or the Jiva. Because through this, you can realize Krishna and get the highest bliss. So on the physical, mental, and spiritual levels, it is very, very effective. It affects all levels. Yeah. And that's so the mantra can go through all these different levels and affect your DNA and your chakras and your subtle body and the Atman, and this way you get highest realization. So this way we can not only simply but deliver the mind, we actually deliver the jiva and give the jiva the highest bliss possible in the material spiritual worlds. And through that, then we get out of the material world, we enter into the spiritual world. So this is the easiest process of getting to that highest level in the spiritual world. That is through chanting the name of Krishna. So we do that, and then we have all success. So we should never underestimate the power of the name of the Lord. It looks like simple sound, but actually it's spiritual sound, and it's coming from the highest level of the spiritual world, from Krishna himself, in his blissful aspect. So therefore, by doing that, we can get out of the material world and get to the spiritual world and realize Radha and Krishna. Okay. Any question?
In terms of how we see the results with the body, like it's automatically happening, the improvement is how it relates to stress. But when it comes to Atma level, there is also philosophy behind, like how the mantra chanting goes along with our bhavan service. It seems to be more complex, like in the sense there is so much endeavor to be done to get liberated out of from the material world. Then we see the results of what we go through with the mind, say the feeling of stress and the effects of the body is more quicker. But when it comes to the liberation of the body itself, the Atma, it becomes more difficult, or it's not very easily seen.
Well, to get liberation is not so difficult. So we see that even Ajamil, simply by accidentally chanting the name of Narayan, got all his karmas removed. Yamaraj couldn't touch him anymore, there's no karmas there. So if you got all your karmas removed, you can get liberation. To get prema and go to Vaikuntha or Maloka, that's more difficult. So that's why we require shiksha, etc. Some proper knowledge to point yourself in the right direction, etc. But to get the liberation, so being the material benedictions or whatever, not so difficult, and even get liberation, not so difficult. If you want to get prema, then we do have to have, you know, avoid aparanas, avoid anarthas, etc., and develop devotion nicely to get to prema.
Prabhu, you said, it's for the scripture, these are not the real eyes, these are not the real ears.
Yeah.
But the thing is, say somebody gets blind due to some reason, and they can't see, so. Yeah. Isn't that this eyes we can
two sets of eyes? So you could try fixing a physical eye, and sometimes it doesn't work. And why is that? Because they didn't fix the subtle eye. Okay. And if you fix a subtle eye, then you get a remarkable effect on the physical eye as well. So that sometimes people miraculously get cured from certain diseases or from blindnesses. The stories of people that have been blind from birth, but suddenly they can see. But they go through some sort of spiritual transformation or something, and then on this other eye or something, and then they can see. So that's why medicine is a little limited, you know, modern medicine thinks only of this eye. I guess there are other subtle eyes, and of course that may have the spiritual eye behind that, but even the two levels of physical, subtle and gross, that hasn't been investigated yet. If we could, science can do that, they could cure more diseases from them.
Thanks, Maharaj. We have a material body, material senses, and also when we go to when we leave this body, and then the senses
go with us.
Go with us.
And the pranas go with you also.
And what happened to that when we go to the spiritual world, the same senses are coming or different?
No. You have to develop spiritual senses through bhakti. If you don't develop bhakti and you just get liberation, then you're stuck in Brahman with no senses again. No spiritual senses, just Atman's there without developed spiritual senses. So if you want to develop spiritual senses that you can see the Lord with, then you have to do bhakti. And then you develop eye, ear, etc. You're chanting the holy name of the Lord, we're looking at the form of the Lord. So we gradually develop spiritual eye and spiritual senses, and then we can see the Lord in Bhava.
sometimes we hear that spiritual senses are already there, it is covered or something.
Oh, well, they're potential, what you're saying. But they won't develop unless we do bhakti. And we get the liberation. No, they don't develop.
So these material senses are not
useful? No, separate.
Thank you.
Maharaj, how would someone who is like has got impaired hearing or deaf will be affected by the sound vibration?
Yeah. Well, as I said, it's subtle, so it's spiritual for one thing. So that does not depend upon your either your gross ear or your subtle material ear. It's a spiritual thing in itself, so you can still get the spiritual effect even if you couldn't hear properly. Because it's part of sound. Even in the material world, we have gross sound, which you can hear. Then we have sound with microphones, which is a little bit artificial, like that. And then we have recorded sound, which is maybe even a little more distant. And then we have completely mechanical sounds, actually. You can reproduce everything with a machine now, all those sounds, and it's still we can understand there's words or there's music, etc., but it's just a bunch of electronic vibrations, actually, which got nothing. It's got nothing to do with the person who originally delivered it. So it's quite unrelated to that person. So what shakti does that have when we just have some thing coming out of your computer or something, which is a bunch of electronic stuff that's not even related to the person who originally spoke it? Has it got the shakti of the original or not? That's a big question. Maybe it has a little bit, not quite the same thing as the original speaker speaking, I think. Yeah? So that's why even in the material world, they pay a lot of money just to hear a singer in person rather than just to hear the recording or see the television. Yeah? They'll take a ticket, possibly $100, to go and see a live concert of somebody because there's a little bit of something else there as well when you get the personal presence of the person there. So the further you get away from that, we get more electronic sound, etc., then we'll probably lose something also. That's just materially speaking. You know?
Just on this point, Maharaj, then what was spiritually recorded?
So in one sense we can say it's good, but then we do have to also say maybe it's not as powerful as the person himself when he's speaking directly. The person who originally heard Prabhupada speak that lecture, probably it would be a little bit different from the one you get in on your, you know, on your iPad or whatever, your iPhone or whatever. Maybe the sounds are a little different. You can pick up the logical portions with sound, the words, sentences, etc. But there's maybe something lacking also, the personal presence of the person. Which is why in ancient India they just carried on the Vedas by direct instruction, guru to disciple, guru to disciple, guru to disciple. No tape recording, nothing in between. No books, nothing. This oral sound and hearing it, you know, getting the message through a person.
Maharaj, what are the benefits of what benefits do you do? I think even in Prabhupada, because he's a charity, that the Prabhupada's privacy will always be there in the present.
What's that?
What would give that Prabhupada being a charity, that his privacy will be fully present?
Yeah. It is in one sense, like all the acharyas and Lord Chaitanya, whatever, Krishna, even if they're not personally there, there's some power coming through, etc. But at the same time, for instance, Prabhupada, so many things are there which we can read and we can try to interpret and whatever, so we get a little puzzled by, you know, things. Yeah. So we have big arguments with each other, does that mean this or mean that? So some things are a little bit unclear to us. So in that sense, if he's personally there, no argument at all, just ask him, get an answer finished. Nobody will argue anymore. So there's, you know, a certain level maybe this is available to us, and certain other things which maybe not available to us also. So there's something there, but maybe not the whole thing. And that goes for all the literatures we have in the past also. Yes, we can get something from when we don't get the whole thing, but it's something better than nothing, obviously.
We heard about different levels of sound, right? Everything has vibrations. So even when we chant Hare Krishna Mahamantra, Again, we can chant at different levels, right? Very loudly, then little lower, you know? Yeah. So we can have different levels of chanting.
And also different levels of devotion.
Yeah. So, which is more effective to chant, like, you know?
Yeah.
We heard about Parapashanti Madhyamanam Vaikari. So same person chanting at different levels, which is more effective?
Well, for us, we're chanting, so we're using our voice, we're using the ear, etc. So we're using the Vaikari sound at the moment. But behind that is the para. It goes with it anyway. Yeah? But the more devotion you have, then I would say the more that activates that para sound. It activates it more effectively. If you accidentally chant it, then it has little effect. And if you have the devotion, a deep devotion, then it's going to have more effect. The para aspect's going to influence the atma more and you get quicker realization.
But Krishna speaks in the Bhagavad Gita that he is the syllable Om in the mantras.
Yeah.
So when we see mostly people are chanting who are not in Krishna Sampradaya chanting Om, it's they're mostly connected to Brahmavadis.
No, Om is also represents Vishnu. So it's not just impersonal. Now, of course, my bodies and impersonals will also chant Om or whatever. But when we chant it, we understand it's Vishnu or Supreme Lord. So then it's the Vaishnava mantra also.
We talked about the Hare Krishna Mahamantra and the sound and its effects on various levels. So obviously, how important it is to chant the mantra properly. If we chant it in a distorted form, it may give some effect, but may not give you the full effect. So, is there something like proper pronunciation sound and a distorted sound?
Yeah. Well, of course, in the scriptures it says whether it's perfectly chanted or imperfectly chanted, it still has effect. Yeah? And even if it's half chanted, even. So, in the Bhagavad, it says if it's only on the tip of your tongue, even, it has very great effect. So it's not completely even pronounced. Obviously, if it's completely pronounced, it has better effect. But even if it isn't, and this is what we call namabhas, it's either incorrectly pronounced or half pronounced, etc., or accidentally pronounced in another word or something like that. Still, it has some effect, and it can destroy karmas and things like that. If we really want the highest effect, then of course we have to be more precise. And more than being precise, we also have to have the devotion behind it. Then we can get to prema. So, of course, the more accurate we are on all levels, then of course the better it is. But the devotion is most essential, I would think. Even if you can't pronounce it correctly or whatever, but the devotion, then that's good also.
So the sound is one level of...
Yeah, and we're dealing with the Vaikari aspect now, but then the Para aspect is also there, so that may differ from your external sound, because like Chinese, they cannot say Krishna properly, they have another way of saying it. But I think it's not a problem for them, because at least the Para aspect is still there, and their devotion is still there, so they still get the effect.
Thanks, Maharaj. Thank you for such a wonderful class and great illustrations for us to understand. I wanted to ask you a question was that, like you stated, the Hare Krishna Mahamantra or the word Krishna being the supreme, but Krishna also says that bigger than me are my devotees. So, if I take that as a principle statement, if there is a mantra which is amalgamation of the Shuddha devotees, their sound and vibration should be higher and therefore it should be more beneficial.
Well, that's why we say that the mantra is delivered through the devotees, or even the name of Krishna is delivered through the devotees. So you only hear Hare Krishna through devotees, and that's how we get it. So it's always with devotees, it's understood. So the name is there, but how do we get the name? How do we hear it? We go down the street and we hear kirtan of devotees. So we're getting it through devotees again. Or you hear recording, it's from devotees.
Yeah. What I wanted to ask Maharaj was that the mantra itself, instead of the name, let's say Krishna, which is the
supreme. Oh, okay, yeah, the devotees' names as well.
Yeah, because Krishna is saying that higher than me are my devotees.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I derive more love.
Yeah. Okay, so we could also chant the name of the devotees, nothing wrong with that. in Nectar of Devotion there, it says that all the aspects of devotional service mentioned there, hearing, chanting, remembering, are concerning the Lord. But then it also says anything related to the devotee also, same. So you could also do that. But of course, Lord Chaitanya gave us this particular mantra, so we chant this. And it was his instruction. But in doing so, we have to also worship Lord Chaitanya. And, of course, his devotees.
Where is consciousness?
Well, we're assuming all human beings are conscious. When you're hearing or whenever you're speaking or saying the mantras, all with consciousness. So the Atma is involved in all of this. When we say the mantra, then the consciousness is there, and we're saying you should chant with devotion. So that devotion is also not the mind, it's in the Atma. So it's the consciousness of the Atma, which is saying the name of Krishna with devotion. So therefore the consciousness is there at all times with the hearing or speaking the mantra.
Scientifically, sound travels through a medium.
Yeah.
There is no medium, there is no sound.
Yeah. Vedic is a little different. It goes through the ether, which we don't know what it is. Yeah. Which is like space or something, but it's not actual blank space, obviously. It's something else. It's some sort of mysterious medium by which the waves go, but it's not the air, it's something else. That's the Vedic source of sound, is ether. But I don't know how we define that in modern science. Of course, there were some scientists, early scientists, that had a theory of ether also. I don't know which ones, but there were some early scientists who talked about ether as well. They thought it was something, not just space, it was something in there that conveyed these waves.
And one more question. This waves, the sound vibration, sound is defined as an interruption on a platform. Like there's, when there are interruptions, you have this frequency which gives you the sound. So when it's spiritual, what is that interruption? What is that sound?
It wouldn't operate the same way with sound waves and molecules of air and whatever like that. So it's quite different. And its medium is not even ether. That spiritual sound is beyond the whole thing. So it's got to do with the Atma and the Supreme Lord, things like that. So it's beyond all, you could say, material mediums.
And the sound vibration, it starts from the spiritual level, which we all have.
Yeah.
And Paramatma is also there. So the sound that's coming through from our heart, like through from our soul, is it coming from Mahamudra?
Well, you could say, what is it, Narasimhadasa says, it comes from the loka, enters into the jiva, and then comes out on his tongue. So the spiritual part of us is the Atma, but it has to come from somewhere. So it comes from Krishna and Goloka, comes to us and manifests on our tongue.
Maharaja, where does this kind of offenses sit in this whole cycle?
Oh, yeah, so offenses are basically in their bad form, their harmful form, means hostility towards the Lord and his devotees and the process of bhakti. So obviously we're talking about devotion, chant with devotion, or at least if it's accidental, it's not offensive. And so when it's offensive, then the effects go down to zero almost because of that hostility. If it's accidental, there's no hostility, like Kashmir, no hostility, just chant the name of Narayan because it's the name of the son. So then you got karma's all destroyed. But if we had offense and chanting, then karmas would not get destroyed. So offenses basically are, like you say, they just take out the whole spiritual aspect. and we have a material sound.
Is it okay to chant while driving or while walking?
Well, there's no hard and fast rules for chanting. But at the same time, we, as devotees, we should try to concentrate as much as possible.
So if you chant while driving, because the focus is not there, there's no use, or?
Well, yeah, I said anyway, there's no hard and fast rules, but for devotees, we try to concentrate so that if we can arrange for some time where we don't have to think of something else while we're chanting is better, more effective for us.
I'm not sure if you can see that show how water is affecting us now. Takes some different qualities according to the environment and the cell vibration projected there.
Yeah.
And also, you mentioned how the Vedas are bringing the vision. I've always wondered why there's so many statements in Shastra dismissing the Vedas, like saying not to be attached to the Vedas, or can you explain that?
No, attached.
There's many references that like almost dismiss the Vedas.
Oh, that's the material aspects of the Vedas, which are teaching about, you know, going to Svargaloka and getting material benefits from, you know, chanting and doing sacrifices and things like that. And Krishna says, okay, the three Vedas, that's for the three Vedas because they deal with the material flowery words of the Vedas, etc. So somehow that's the karma kanda section of the Vedas. So parts of the Vedas, yes, but not the whole Vedas. So though we kind of derive the Vedas, at the same time they do have their spiritual part, and that part we recommend. Upanishads and whatever.
Is that also coming from Vishnu life?
The whole thing does. So he presents, like Bhagavad Gita, Krishna does karma yoga, and then chapter 3 says worship demigods and stuff like that. So it's part of the Vedas. For less advanced people who don't have any spiritual impetus or whatever, let them at least get up to Sattva-gun and maybe go to Svargaloka, whatever. But one should progress beyond that and then go to Jnana Yoga or Bhakti Yoga. So it's like one step for those people that can't even get to Bhakti Yoga directly, but at least purify their material existence and get up to Sattva-gun. So it's, but it's secondary, so that's why Krishna ultimately will be rejected and just do Bhakti Yoga, because it's so secondary and indirect. But it's there as a gradual process for people in general. And Kali Yuga is not very practical because there's no Varnashram system in time. So therefore he says this to, do Bhakti. It's there in the traditional system as part of this. So we don't disrespect it in one sense, but we also don't insist everybody follow. We're more emphasis, we put on more emphasis on the Bhakti because that's the ultimate goal.
Narak, you said that beside our physical senses, you have like a subtle senses as well.
Yeah.
So sometimes in night time, when you have bad dreams,
yeah,
and you want to take Krishna's name, it's kind of hard. You have like the tongue is tied.
Yeah.
So what's the really meaning?
That means we don't have too much control even of our subtle senses, what to speak of our gross senses. Even the subtle senses, that you have dreams, but you really can't control the dreams, and you don't know where they're going or whatever. So in our subtle body also, we don't have so much control at this particular time. If you're a yogi, then you control the gross and the subtle senses a lot, and you get all sorts of mystic powers and things like that. Or you can travel up your body and do many different things. But you don't have control of either, so that's why the dreams are very unpredictable.
We saw several instruments which measure the effects of the sound, the form of the sound, and so on. So they were very complex scientific instruments. On our personal level, is there any effects we can measure ourselves?
I don't know if you have any purpose in doing this. They're not actually so complicated. I think these instruments, it's quite a simple instrument actually. You just get the little sand on top of that little plate and you connect that to the thing, and then you get all these different effects. You can do it with water also. You can have a water bowl and you connect the vibrating thing to that and you get all these patterns in the water. So it's not so complicated.
One of the slides mentioned about mantra, which is something that delivers the mind. What does it really mean?
If you use mantra, then what the yogis do, their whole attempt is to control the senses in the mind,
and stop all the thoughts, processes, and then finally the ahankara, then they realize atma. So the basic problem of the material world is our senses are uncontrolled and they're going out seeking all sorts of things in this world, and we get so involved with that we never think about atma or Supreme Lord. So mantra makes us concentrate the senses and the mind on form of the Lord, who is the subject of the mantra. And that way, we control the mind and the senses, and concentrate on the Lord, and we also spiritualize it at the same time. And this way, we can get rid of the material world completely, as you see here, and get to the spiritual realm.
Srila Prabhupada mentions about some Dr. Bose experience.
Well, he was just talking about plants also. Yeah. The plants, the life of plants or something like that. I don't know exactly what his experiments were, but he showed how they weren't so unintelligent as we think they are. And they do have some sort of senses or whatever like that. So, the plants are not, you know, that we think there's no brains and whatever like that. We do have some level of sensitivity because they're sensitive to music and they know good music and bad music and things like this, and they grow in, you know, harmonious environments and they don't like other environments, but they're sensitive also.
Prince Charles did that as well,
huh?
Experiment on plants.
Oh, Prince Charles, I heard that also. Yeah. Many people have done experiments of praying also. Pray to the plants, and if you pray nicely, they grow nicely. If you curse them, they start dying, etc. Like this, so you know, some very subtle influences that we can't pick up, but the plants can also pick those up and those vibrations. They'll grow or not grow according to that.
It is said that one should not hear about Krishna and his pastimes from non-devotees, but if they are speaking similar pastimes or Krishna, maybe not twistingly philosophically, what is the effect that it has on the hearer?
Yeah. Well, the thing is like we speak and we can speak through a microphone. If the microphone's good, then you can hear. If the microphone's pretty bad, then you may not even get the correct message out of the microphone. So like that, the scriptures are pure by nature because they're non-different than the Supreme Lord. They come out of the wrong microphone. They pick up the wrong sound, the wrong meaning or whatever like that. So if we have people who don't believe in Krishna reciting the same pastimes, we tend to pick up a different message from what a devotee would speak. And therefore it becomes not very effective.
The names are Rama, Krishna, Shiva, Indra, Brahma, Saraswati. These names are found in the Bible, but they don't really acknowledge it. I find that they will not acknowledge it.
Yeah. So the names are everywhere, universal. Okay. Hare Krishna.